Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu. Hi guys, welcome to another archive episode from November 2020. Dr. Laura Jansen's and now Dr. Skip Wren is a part of the show back then. Enjoy guys, see you next week. Thank you all for joining us again, once again, on the NeuroNoodle Network podcast featuring our neuropsychologists, Dr. Laura Jansen's and Dr. Skip Wren. Did I say it right this time, Doc?
Got it, you got it.
All right, getting better. That neurofeedback's paying off for me. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, you know, Twitter. Help us out. Today we're going to answer our listener questions on depression. So stand by for that. I'd also like to give a shout out to Asht Mishra, PhD. He's a clinical neuroscientist and director at NCI Clinical Research Foundation. We've talked to him for a while. Great, great guy. Always follows us. All right. Book you should know. Skip, you gave us a couple. Grain Brain and Brainwash. The Broken Brain. Tell us quickly about those.
So Dr. David Perlmutter used to have a practice down here in Naples, Florida. And his approach to the dementias was from the gut-brain health relationship versus traditional approaches to dementias, which is, you come up with a diagnosis and you tell folks to get their affairs in order, and that's it for that treatment. So he's approached it differently with the idea that the treatment, if you will, the way to kind of go after dementias is a preventative approach, and it starts in your 20s and 30s, and it absolutely 1,000% involves diet, consciousness of your environment, managing sleep, making sure you're engaging in healthy relationships, getting exercise, getting outside, monitoring screen time, all the things you would think and on some level know that probably aren't awesome for you. He's saying really, really matter these days. And because of the overwhelming, availability of all those things, meaning the ease at which it is to participate in all those negative habits, right, is what's contributing to these staggering numbers of dementias. So that's Dr. Perlmutter. The second book, Brainwash, is with his son, who's also a neurologist. And they've come together and are trying to highlight the link between, hey, here's what we know, and here's what you need to do, what's in between there, in that things aren't happening, right? So as physicians, they're prescribing things all the time to folks, you know, not just meds, but lifestyle choices, but it's not happening. So what's the catch, And so again, it's this reinforcement of the idea that there's factors out there that impede our ability to be able to do what we want to do, which is be happy and healthy and all those good things. It's not just an issue of willpower. They go as far as saying it's quite the opposite. It's that things are working against our willpower, not only making it harder, but chipping away at this quote notion of willpower in the first place. And then Dr. Hyman is a functional medicine guy, a pretty prominent voice in the field. I worked out of the Cleveland Clinic. Now he's got his own thing going. But about 3 or 4 years ago, he put a series together called the Broken Brain Series, which is where I kind of got my taste for it, no pun intended, with kind of keto approaches to things. And I've been following his work, and he has a couple podcasts out there and a whole bunch of books.
So we're going to put links to the books on the NeuroNoodle website. You'll see it under blogs and podcasts. Check them out. Grain Brain, anything to do with glutens on that one?
Maybe a little.
Yeah. A little? All right. I'm going to tell my wife about that.
Definitely. It is, pardon sarcasm, the idea is that we just haven't evolved to be able to handle the new grains. Doesn't mean you can't eat bread. That's the pushback. Hey, I've been eating bread my whole life. What about people in Europe? They eat bread. They're fine. We have different bread, right? Our farming industry is subsidizing ways without getting political on this podcast, but it's led to the foods we eat being not healthy for us, and our bodies just haven't adapted. So these things are impacting us negatively. That's grain brain. Sorry.
Got it. All right. Awesome. All right. You guys ready to hit our main topic everybody wants to know about?
Sure.
Depression. What is depression?
So again, back to the DSM, we referred to that last time, and we'll probably refer to it every time that a diagnosis is presented. But depression is a disorder, and it's probably commonly thought of how it presents itself. So sad feelings, lack of energy, lack of motivation, lack of enjoyment in things you used to enjoy. There's varying degrees of depression. There's major depression, and that's probably what folks go to in their minds, I'm guessing, with, you know, the shades drawn, can't get out of bed kind of thing. Thoughts of self-harm creep in, right? Despair, hopelessness. I'm getting bummed out, mentioning all the things, right? It's a drag and it's a downer. That's major disorder or a major depression. There's others within this category, within the DSM, of the depressive disorders. And so there's something called persistent depressive disorder, which is more of a depression light, if you will. You're certainly able to function in your life. You're just bummed out more than not. And I don't mean to minimize or belittle it, but it's not major depressive disorder. It's a functioning depression. There's a few others in there. There's in regards to kids in general, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is a newer one with the more recent version of the DSM, and it's tantrums, it's irritability, it's caustic reactions. There's parameters on when you can prescribe it even, or I'm sorry, diagnose it. And you can't do it before 6 and you can't do it after 18. So it kind of captures childhood into adolescence, right? And then it bails out right before adulthood. So it's this way to again, recognize that depression looks different across the lifespan. Kids don't always get bummed out and, you know, go in their room, although they do. Sometimes they're just irritable and they lash out and nothing is soothing kind of thing. So that's a couple of the different varieties just to point out that, hey, depression isn't one thing. It's a grouping of depressive disorders.
We're defining things, you know, based on the manual we're using to define it, right? So if you use a diagnostic statistical manual, it's a psychiatric, you know, manual that we all follow to put a stamp on people in terms of diagnosis. It's the one the insurance, you know, DSM, the insurance companies communicate using that book, the psychiatrists communicate using that book. So you know, we can call that a limiting diagnostic manual. But When we think of neuropsychology, so you know, me and Skip are both trained in psychology. We both have an extensive history of being psychotherapists, and we'll talk about that. How psychotherapy diagnoses depression, but neuropsychology. So we're looking at brain and behavior connections. You know, we look at, you know, what are people doing and what does that tell us about their brain? And we assess that, you know, using traditional paper and pencil tests. And, you know, there's personality tests that we can assess for these things. So when I'm thinking of a, you know, if I was going to do a neuropsychological evaluation and the question has to do with depression, you know, there's many neurological diseases that have depression as, you know, one of their symptoms. So, you know, it'll be common for us to get someone, for example, with Parkinson's and you know, they're going to have depression as part of their symptom picture. So neuropsychology of depression, I'm thinking about it, as Skip already was talking about, you know, mood. You know, are you sad? Are you dysphoric? You know, you can't get happy. Even doing things you like to do, you just can't, you know, find pleasure in it. So that's the mood piece of depression. And then the mood and affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, affect is the behavior display of depression. So you can look at someone, you can imagine someone as, you know, you listen to these podcasts, what does a depressed person look like? They're tearful, their body posture is, you know, slumping or just slow moving, slow, you know, talk about the motor aspect of depression, that they're just slow going. They can't get a lot done. They're, you know, stereotypically sitting or laying, basically doing nothing or, you know, using their thumbs on their devices and kind of scrolling around at nothing or, you know, switching the TV channels to essentially nothing. So there's a mood, there's an affect, there's a motor component. And motivation, we talked about motivation a little bit last week when we were addressing anxiety. You know, they're the same brain structures. You know, when we talk about anxiety and depression, so there's going to be diminished motivation. Just don't feel like doing anything. Don't want to go anywhere. What do you want to do today? I don't know. What do you want to do? Just no juice, no electricity. And then, you know, there's a cognitive content. And that's where we get into the psychotherapy definitions of depression. You know, what are you thinking about? What do depressed people think about? They think that the world is ending. It's never going to get better. I'm no good. There's this brain system, brain network called the default mode network. And basically what that means is when we're sitting around doing nothing, even if your mood is fine, when you're sitting around doing nothing, you're prone to what they call self-referential thinking. And it's judgmental. I should do this. I should do that. And a little bit of that is fine. A little bit of, you know, self-correction is fine. Oh, hey, I need a new pair of shoes, or I need a haircut, or I got to change this or that, or I, you know, said something stupid yesterday. I should, you know, correct that and go on. Someone who has depression just can't let that stuff go. They just sit and, you know, we'll say obsess or can't shut off those self-referential judgmental thoughts. You know, nothing's going to get better. Again, I'm no good. I'll never get a job and or whatever it is. I'll never finish this project. I can't do anything right. See, everybody who criticized me ever in my lifetime, they were right. So there's this huge cognitive content to depression as well. So we have mood, affect, motivation, what you're thinking about, and this motor feature where everything is kind of slowed down. And, you know, there's, you know, aspects of, you know, we talk about, you know, what you're thinking about, this aspect of, you know, suicidal thinking, you know, can get into that and gets into a, you know, kind of scary crisis place. But it's, yeah, this kind of this message to yourself, like there's no way out. And the only way out is to check out. And so, you know, depression can obviously become pretty serious.
So it's a loop of negative voices in your head.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, we're going to split hairs on, you know, when I start to, you know, go down that road of, you know, neuroscience, right, you know, dishing out what the brain's up to. But it's pretty normal actually to have depressing thoughts, because depressing thoughts can motivate us to do stuff. Again, to say, you know, I need a haircut or I need to change some aspect of myself or what I'm doing. that's a negative thought. It has a judgmental piece to it. A degree of that is very normal, and we should all have that. But I think the point, you know, when we start getting into, you know, adults and, you know, more developed thinking, that we should be able to, should be able to talk ourselves into a better frame of mind. And the average person who's not depressed can generally do that. You can wake up in a, excuse the language, or a crappy mood or a low mood. But most people, especially, you know, again, people who are not depressed, can go, hey, you know what, it's this ain't the end of the world. Keep going, at a girl, at a boy, push through, and you're going to feel better once you accomplish this thing. And you can self-motivate and shut off those default thoughts, the I'm no good thoughts. It's easier to shut them off if you don't have depression.
Are people born with it? I mean,
with depression? I think we're born with the default mode network. And again, we're getting into brain science. And what I mean by networks, different areas of your brain light up when you're doing different things. They're networks, they're patterns. It used to be back in the earlier part of my education and career that they would talk about, you know, one part of the brain did one thing. If you're depressed, that must be a front left hemisphere issue, because people who've had strokes in the front left hemisphere tend to be depressed. So it's a lesion theory. And again, where I'm getting all sciencey, but the point is that when you're doing nothing, your brain tends to wander on negative thoughts or judgy thoughts. When you start doing something, when you start getting involved in anything, even if it's rearranging your you know, shelves in your kitchen, when you start doing anything, those self-referential thoughts stop. Like, so you could switch networks and switch in and out of things. And, you know, that could be some clues into how people can, you know, work to help themselves. So it's a psychotherapy intervention. I mean, we're starting to talk about mindfulness-based treatment for depression. You know, looking at these patterns, you know, we're doing neurofeedback, and we can do neuroimaging, and I can, you know, look at someone's brain map and say, hey, yeah, there's that left hemisphere deal that we know can get botched up and or get dysregulated in depression. And we can, you know, work very directly at making that more regulated.
Somebody comes in, what is the general course of action? If you don't have an EEG in your office and you don't know anything about neurofeedback, someone comes in, they say they're depressed, and you have a doctor whose background is to look it up in the DSM. How does that process normally work for somebody that hasn't even gone to a psychologist before?
Are you meaning specifically without access to maybe neurofeedback?
I'm a dad. I'm a mom. My kid's depressed. I'm going to, you know, they got to go talk to somebody.
It seems, and again, kind of in my experience in my career, is that folks go to their pediatrician. Or even these days, maybe they'll talk to somebody in their school and they'll recommend counseling or therapy. And I would say still, Laura, correct me from your geographical area, that talk therapy is still the way to go with some kind of medicinal management. That seems to be the overwhelming kind of treatment thrust, if you will. There's just other ways that are coming about these days that I think podcasts like this are able to illuminate for people, right? But real quick, I just want to answer your question about, are you born with depression? And I think there are genetic components to it. And so there's also the environment that helps shape the development of your genetics to some degree, right? So back to the joke, that's not really a joke, but is it nature or nurture? And the answer is yes. And certainly environmental events can happen to shape things in certain directions, absolutely, right? Traumas and other things that you know, are unpleasant would definitely steer someone towards maybe developing a way of interpreting their environment on an unconscious level that could lead to the rumination or repetition of these default mode networks that over time would then lead to more preferred ways of being. When I say prefer, I don't mean positive, but more habitual ways of interpreting one's environment. You could say that in regular language of just your outlook is shaped by your environment and your background and genetics. And I'm still on board with that. I'm thinking you are too, Laura, for the most part.
Sure, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you think of the, you know, get back into more regular language, if you're feeling, okay, we're in, you know, still in COVID and actually, you know, heading into the winter here in the Midwest, we're in Illinois, and, you know, things are starting to shut down more because people are going inside and all of that. And so, you know, we've been feeling helpless and hopeless. Things have been canceled. You know, everyone is in the same, you know, ship here with, yeah, weddings are canceled and you can't, you know, someone's in the hospital, you can't visit them, all that stuff. So helpless, hopeless. And, you know, how could that not cause depression? Like we, you know, if we're not depressed, there's something wrong, you know, right? So, but, you know, there are ways to move through that. Yes, you can be biologically predisposed to depression and kind of no matter what, you know, even if there is a vaccine or whatever, you know, the person predisposed to depression, you know, may not feel helpful, you know, or, you know, feel positive even if things situationally do get better. So, you know, it's complex. But yeah, there's definitely, you know, situationally based things that kind of lock you, in, you know, into a corner and you know, yeah, you can, there's, you know, certainly, you know, the family histories that, not just genetically, but, you know, if you're raised in a family where, you know, there's not a lot of hope and, you know, situationally, you know, that's going to carry out and, you know, there's modeling, how do you handle crisis? How do you handle these kinds of things?
So if you're a kid, if you're a parent, your kid, I mean, between the ages of 6 to 18, conceivably, you could be taking drugs and talking to a therapist for at least 12 years. Is that possible?
Longer in some cases, right? Yeah.
Okay. So, well, no, I mean, that's what's happening. And then, you know, the alternative is they can come into one of our offices.
Yes.
Get a brain scan, a QEEG, take a picture, compare it against a quote unquote normal database of brains that don't have the symptoms, and notice the difference. Dr. Laura, Dr. Skip, you want to talk to that? But the alternatives?
I'll let Laura talk about the EEG stuff. I just wanted to put in another option that's now available. And back when Laura and I were going to school, we went to school to do therapy, right? We're clinical psychologists. I mean, to talk to folks, right? Where I didn't get a degree in research, right? I wanted to sit down and talk to folks and do that kind of work in the 25 years I've been doing this. And probably within the last 5 to 10, I've started to recognize that, hey, there's a hell of a lot more going on here than just talking. It's not just a matter of knowing what to do. There's other things that are influencing how we do what we do and even what we're able to do. I'll let Laura talk about neurofeedback for sure, because that's such a powerful tool. The other piece, again, back to the books that were mentioned at the outset here, there's a functional medicine piece to how we work or function as organisms, right? We're human beings, I get it, but we're also organisms operating within our environment. And to have the full capacity of what we're capable of, we have to consider things that might be impeding that. And diet is one major factor that can inhibit or limit our ability to be able to respond to our environment in appropriate ways. And appropriate just means what's best for what's going on. And in this case of depression, we're talking about feeling good, right? And there's other factors like toxins in our environment. And I mean, our local environment, our homes, right? Paint your house and you got paint fumes. That affects neurological functioning. Diet, and I don't mean eating well, I mean the food that's available to us has pesticides on it that affect our gut microbiome. And those things over time affect the link between our gut and our brain and how it communicates and how our brain is then therefore able to function. And if we're talking about mood, that's another piece that needs to be addressed. I'm not taking away from counseling, therapy, or anything like that. I think it's fantastic. It is just now a piece, and it can't be the major piece, in my opinion, because if it was, we'd be done with our work. You wouldn't have to go after 6 to 18. You could do it from 6 to 6, 1 month, because you tell kids what to do, and they'd be like, okay, good, I'll do that. There's just much more involved here. And again, not to take away from the therapeutic relationship and the value of that. It's just there's other pieces. So I'll let Laura talk about the fantastic impact that
neurofeedback. 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida. They're led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess I just want to kind of trail from what you're saying, you know, kind of connect a little bit to what you just said, that, and you mentioned this last week, Skip, that much of how much serotonin's in our gut, say that again, what you said last week, Skip, about the nerve cells and in the gut functioning in relation to the brain.
So only second to the brain does the gut microbiome place in neurons.
Yeah.
Right? Neuron nerve centers or connectors, if you will. So the gut is second and the brain's first. But what the brain or the gut is referred to often in literature is the second brain, right? So now we have this idea of, okay, there's another piece here that is influencing our brain function. And it's not just a casual acquaintance. They have a direct relationship, and the communication pathways going from the gut to the brain and the brain to the gut are actually more active going from the gut to the brain. So who's telling who what to do and who is number one, if you get what I'm saying. So there's a major issue that everybody is aware of, because we all know inflammation. But the idea is that there's an overexposure, if you will, to this inflammation state that leads to, over time, because it's steady, right, that it leads to things. And one thing in particular that, again, folks might be aware of, but it's called a leaky gut. And a leaky gut means things that are supposed to stay in are able to get out, and vice versa, things that are outside are able to get in. And not to be an alarmist, but just if we're looking at a system, it's not supposed to work that way, right? Things are supposed to go where they're supposed to go. And the continual impact of this process of a leaky system is, again, over time, it's going to impair functioning. And so that's where the focus is, if you will, from this functional medicine perspective. And again, functional meaning kind of holistic, looking at how systems function, versus traditional Western medicine. You got a runny nose, you take an antihistamine. Functional medicine is going to look at what's going on with that system that's kicking out histamines. Is there something that's wrong with the system? Is there something influencing the system, et cetera, et cetera? Anyway, back to where you're going. These things have to operate cohesively, and with this kind of exposure to the things we are, which is a diet that might not be great for us, a perpetual, if you will, fight or flight system switch being flipped on because we live in stressful times, and we're also exposed to things on a level we've never have been with the advent of phones and news feeds and all this good stuff. And then you throw in something like COVID, which is a double whammy, because now you're getting all this information while you're locked in solitude.
Yep.
And so, okay.
So the number I have read is that well over 90 to 95% of our serotonin is mediated in our gut.
Okay.
You heard that? Yeah. So
I have.
Yeah. So when we talk about serotonin, you know, that's the chemical in the brain that they regulate when you're taking antidepressant medication. So you take your Lexapros and your Prozacs and those kinds of antidepressant medication. You're trying to make the serotonin run better. And, you know, the point is you got to look at the gut if you're going to look at depression or you're going to look at mood disorders, that's for sure. The reason I'm kind of nailing in on that is that when I was talking about the neuropsychology of depression, I was talking about thought content of someone who's depressed. And when I just want to clarify after I thought about it, that the thought content, that when I was saying helpless, hopeless, that's going to be a symptom probably more specific to adults. Adults are going to be able to, you know, try to process things and come to conclusions about things. And they're the ones who are going to say, I'm feeling helpless and hopeless. And, you know, you have some clues, you know, other people who, you know, listen to, you know, that information from adults, they can, you know, subjectively, you know, say, hey, my dad's depressed or my grandpa's depressed or Aunt Sally. But with children, you know, we were talking about this last week that, there's a nerve that runs from your brain to your gut and, you know, can cause a lot of physical symptoms in the gut when you're anxious. And so what I'm getting at is that with children, when you ask a child, you know, we're trying to figure out symptoms of depression or anxiety, bring that back, because, you know, they overlap a lot. A child is going to say, I have a stomach ache. A child's going to say, I have a headache. A child's going to say, I've got diarrhea. I've got, especially constipation. I don't know how many kids you see, Skip, who have constipation. And yeah, it's all, you know, kind of wrapped back into, you know, gut health and emotional health. And we really want to, you know, pay attention to you know, when a kid's saying, I've got a stomach ache, you know, it's not just, you know, I'm trying to get out of class. There's, you know, more to the story, and we need to pay attention to the children because they're going to express themselves in physiological complaints and gut complaints versus, you know, being able to have these complex thoughts like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to me because, you know, they're not thinking that complex. But I'll kind of run it back to the, you know, the point of neurofeedback. So this training called neurofeedback, it starts with getting a image of the functioning of the brain. We can read the electricity from the brain at the scalp level, take that data, feed it through a computer. The computer can show the individual, child or adult, kind of what their brain's doing. And it could show which parts of the brain are functioning well and which parts aren't. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a signature for depression on these brain maps that I can look at. And typically it's a front left area that is dysregulated. The front left, just by the way, has to do with not just controlling your mood, because there's an, as I was mentioning a little bit earlier, that yeah, I mean, you can wake up in kind of a cruddy mood and then kind of talk yourself, so to speak, out of that, and that's what the front left does. It helps you kind of think things through in a logical way, take in information that can update, you know, reality for you and help you kind of challenge your thinking and be a little bit more logical about you know, what's going on. So those folks, just by the way, who have that front left dysregulation, they are the exact people who are going to, I say to the patients all the time, and I mean this a little, somewhat tongue in cheek, but they're going to stink at psychotherapy, because psychotherapy is about change your thinking, right? Your logic is off, you're being irrational. And the message isn't knock it off as much as, hey, here's the goal. We're trying to get you to change your thoughts. And if your front left is dysregulated, you're the person who's going to be the worst at it. And so with neurofeedback, you know, again, what we're doing, we're feeding back to the individual, to the organism, hey, you're dysregulated there. And we can make corrections by having people, you know, watch movies or have some other feedback, whether it's music or a sound of some type. Kids or even adults do this. We have video games that when the media is playing properly, like if there's a movie playing, when the movie is playing properly, that's feedback to the person, hey, your brain's doing the right thing. It's no longer dysregulated in that front left area. And when the movie stops playing because the computer's in charge of setting rewards and cutting the rewards, when the movie plays, you know, regularly, then the feedback to the individual is, hey, your brain's working right. And so the more reward-based training like that, the more regulated that brain area can become, and the repetitive trainings help, we'll say correct, and that's maybe too strong, but help regulate is probably the better word, regulate the functioning in that area. The more repetitions, it sticks, and you know, when we're done working that area, then we're done. So, you know, if it takes 10, 20, 30 sessions, that's still a drop in the bucket compared to, as Pete was referring to, yeah, you can go to therapy for 10 years and challenge your thinking. But if you don't, you know, that's the question. If you don't fix things or correct things at the physiological level, you know, where exactly are you going? So that's how neurofeedback is designed to, you know, we can take a picture, see the area dysfunctioning, or we might all be surprised. This happens to us all the time. You know, someone will say it, come in and say, I think I'm depressed. They just know because that's how they've identified themselves. They'll come and say, I'm depressed. And we'll take a picture and go, you know, I'm not going to challenge how you feel. Okay, you feel how you feel. But, you know, the anxiety is actually looking like a worse problem because it's a right hemisphere, you know, thing that's dysregulated. How about we, you know, instead of hitting the depression right away, why don't we hit the right hemisphere and see if that, you know, can make things better. So having the objective data is basically, you know, bottom line is, you know, we can confirm, validate, hey, yeah, you got that brain that looks like the signature for depression, or you don't. And, you know, we can kind of tweak things, you know, chase the symptoms or, you know, correct things toward the average normative database. So we have a lot of ways of getting after things with the neurofeedback training.
Talk therapy and medication, that could be the way to do it. This is another way to do it. You know,
so what we see in, you know, maybe it's, you know, pendulum can keep swinging the other way, but what we're seeing is people come in, you know, medication doesn't help everybody. I mean, there's a percentage of people, and it's a huge percentage, that medication doesn't help. Talk therapy, as I was referring to, if your brain's kind of dysregulated, you could do talk therapy for the next 20 years and still not get, quote, it, you know, not, you know, kind of cross that bridge. Some people, you know, the average person might, but there's plenty of people at the physiological, genetic, you know, whatever level that don't get better with medication or therapy. So, you know, here's another option. Like, you know, what if it was the missing link for you, and you know, why not try and see?
If I could add, at this point in my career, I'm really comfortable saying that of the options, I feel like neurofeedback, based on experience and having seen it in my office, that neurofeedback gets after more than the others individually. And that's, again, coming back to this idea that, hey, meds don't work for everybody. And actually sometimes meds have adverse effects because of individual neural anatomy and neural functioning. Therapy doesn't work for everybody because it doesn't. Neurofeedback has a way of allowing the brain to train itself to operate more efficiently. And I know that's kind of jargony talk, but the brain does learn through these reinforcements or feedback the thresholds in which to operate, which are determined by providers. That's what we do, right? You set those parameters. And then again, the brain quickly learns, okay, if I stay in this range, I'm going to get my treat, which is to watch this movie. And I like it. Consciously, meaning the human sitting in the seat that's watching the movie, you don't have to do anything. The brain's doing it behind the scenes. And again, that's the beauty of it. But the secondary beauty of it is that these impacts from this training oftentimes, and again, this is my experience, Laura and Pete, you can speak to yours too, is you often have things that result that you weren't anticipating. And so you're going after maybe depression or anxiety or whatever the presenting symptoms or deficits are. And then 3 weeks down the road, you'll have a kid say, hey, my handwriting's better. And my teachers are blown away because now they can actually read my handwriting. And you're sitting there scratching your head going, how the hell did that happen? Right? We're here because you were pulling your eyebrows out. Right? What's going on here? And, you know, we could probably talk our way through it and maybe come up with some conclusions on why. But my point being is that, yeah, you're focusing on this particular issue or symptom. And the brain's saying, all right, that's great. You guys can do what you want. I'm learning how to operate more efficiently, which is going to allow me to utilize and put my resources where they need to be. And again, from the brain point of view, where resources need to be is wherever the environment is saying they need to be. So your brain's a reacting organ and it's saying, all right, I got to sit down and shut up because I'm in class, or my mom's telling me to do this, or I need to wait 5 minutes to get, well, my popsicle, I can't eat it before dinner, you know, like whatever. I'm simple examples, but the brain's doing what it does, and it will then delegate where this energy or information needs to go to satisfy the most in the environmental demands, right? So,
yeah, and the brain wants normalcy, right? There's a rhythm, there's a natural rhythm that the brain is seeking just intrinsically. It's not a, you know, free will, conscious choice kinds of things. It wants health, it wants normalcy, and the neurofeedback is kind of tweaking, pushing it, you know, toward normal, trying to get the rhythm, get it to self-regulate. You know, we're not going to be self-regulating, you know, again, for the next 10 years. We're going to kind of nudge it in the right direction, and then the brain takes over because that's what it wants. It wants to see the movie, but it, you know, overall though, it wants kind of a natural rhythm, and that's what we're achieving with people. So if the brain is in a natural rhythm and the brain is, you know, responsible for zillions of things, you know, half a zillion things could get better because you've just put the rhythm in place that is achieving a normal, healthy state.
What's got me pretty excited is, you know, being a parent, you know, when you're relying on talk therapy, there has to be talking or communication, and, you know, kids can't communicate what's wrong with them. Like you said before, you know, my tummy hurts. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow. I mean, that could be anxiety, you know, mm-hmm. to take that picture and be able to have the data to say, oh, this is what the issue is, and be able to do something about it. I think that's, mm-hmm. man, I wish you would have had that a few years ago.
I'd say, I don't know, 80s or 90s, I was in, I don't know, some kind of waiting room, and I picked up a Time magazine. And I haven't seen a Time magazine in paper in years, but back then I was compelled to read this article that talked about, it was just a research study, and, you know, the validity, I'd have to look it up and whatever, but it was a compelling study. It was a guy who tried to calculate how many thoughts the average human, we'll say adult probably, how many thoughts the adult has in one day. And what they computed was, we think, and I don't know how they define thoughts exactly, and whatever, split hairs on that too, but the outcome was that we think between 10 and 70,000 thoughts a day.
I've heard that as well. I've heard 40 to 80. So
okay.
Yeah.
In that range. Okay. So it's just interesting stuff. So 10 to 70, 40 to 80, tons and tons of thoughts, right? 90% of those thoughts are repetitive, right? So we're repeating the same, whatever. I need a new pair of shoes 10,000 times a day, or I got to pay that bill, or I, whatever, want to go golfing this weekend, whatever. You repeat that stuff, you know, 10 to 70,000, whatever, 80,000 times a day. 90% of those thoughts don't come true. I'll never work again. I'll never be able to fix this, whatever thing is broken. So, you know, you repeat. So anxiety, you know, there's aspects of anxiety that have worry pieces, right? So I'm going to guess that the people who are anxious or worry prone are going to be at the 70, 80,000 thoughts a day, you know, part of that scale. What I think about is, if you're repeating 80,000 times a day to yourself that I'm no good, I'm never going to get there, it's not happening for me, you know, add up those thoughts in a day, how could you not be depressed? So, you know, there's a hand in glove thing here with, you know, worried thoughts and negative thinking, and, you know, I referred to default mode network, and probably define that better someday. But the point is that, yeah, if you're thinking a lot of thoughts, and a lot of thoughts have a negative valence, negative value, negative quality, you're no doubt going to be depressed. And so I think that's something to think about as we're making these definitions. And, you know, there's a range of, and maybe we can even say that at the 10,000 thoughts side of things, those are the people who are depressed. They're not thinking too much. But again, the point is they overlap. And we can see those things directly on the scans that we do. And be compelling to kind of see that out in real life, like, you know, do a little research on our own. And have, I do that sometimes with my clients. I have them take out a piece of paper and think random thoughts for a minute and then kind of, you know, prorate that out and see how many thoughts per hour and whatever. So it'd be kind of interesting to kind of do that kind of stuff to show people, hey, you know, what you're doing on paper, because I just made you think a ton of thoughts at random, and what your brain map looks like kind of line up. So there's all sorts of ways to use this imaging information to help people. So that's all.
Can I add something on that note?
Yep.
And I want to reference someone who's doing some work in this area, and his name is Dr. Joe Dispenza, D-I-S-P-E-N-Z-A. And what he's done, and he's taken, by the way, the NeuroGuide software, and in his lectures or meetings or wherever you want to refer to them, seminars, conferences, right? He's actually wiring folks up to get cues done while they're doing meditations.
There you go.
And he has some pretty prescribed meditations that he does with folks. So there's the control factor there, at least at the outset. And what he's able to have shown is that, one, our thoughts do play a part in creating our realities. And I know that's kind of a big concept to bite into. We're talking quantum kind of theory stuff, which that's as far as I can say about it, right? It's deep, smart people stuff for sure. But he's able to show this through the EEGs, and he's also able to show through the meditation practice, if you will, meaning over time, and in this case, it's 3 days, right, in these conferences, that folks are able to change their overall EEGs. So for example, if someone showed up on Thursday and they had a EEG that might look like a depressive EEG, that they'd be able to change that in a more preferable direction. So back to this idea of 80,000 thoughts a day, left unguided, they're going to take us in a direction, thoughts that, brains that fire together, wire together, thought processes, right? And they're going to create habitual responses to things. That's the rumination of these 80,000 thoughts. And interventions such as meditation or focus on some of those 80,000 thoughts a day. You don't have to be vigilant, right? That's your whole day. But that it can play a part in also altering the overall function. And so we're talking about neurofeedback here on this podcast for sure. And it's a really powerful intervention. There's some others that are out there too that can be really strongly impactful that, again, can complement, supplement things like neurofeedback. So just to get that out there too, there's some really interesting, powerful things being done.
Yeah, you know what? And I know we're trying to close, but maybe this can help leapfrog into, you know, one of the future sessions here. I want to bring Dr. Lori Russell into this, because, you know, she's the one with the textbook that talks about neurotherapy, which means it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid with, looking, and we'd say analyzing your thoughts or challenging your thoughts, identifying what kind of thoughts are leading to what kind of feelings, because that's our traditional cognitive behavioral therapy. So using that, but doing your traditional therapy, but having the sensors, you know, directly connected to the computer, and we can look at, you know, thinking, you know, these negative thoughts, what it immediately does to your brain function. You could look right up at the screen, hey, I'm having this worried thought, you know, on purpose, make someone worry about something. And you could look right up on the screen and see what part of the brain's lit up and say, okay, hey, there you go. That's what it's physiologically doing to you when you have that thought. And, you know, there's all sorts of whatever kind of approaches to, you know, what do you do about that? But I think having an objective piece involved in the therapy session, you know, absolutely takes it to another level. And that's, you know, where Lori Russell has gone with this, you know, just like me and Skip, you know, she has a phenomenal background. She's an amazing psychotherapist, but then, you know, she adds, you know, this technology, and it just takes it completely to another level. So it'd be nice to have Dr. Russell involved with us in the future to take this idea further.
I'm going to start ramping it up here. That was a good one. Depression. You are what you think about most of the time.
Yep.
I learned that back in my sales day, because if you didn't have a good attitude, you wouldn't sell anything.
Yeah.
Let's see, guys, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
I'll take
six. If you don't like us, give us 6 stars. So guys, take care. Have a great weekend. Over and out. Arrivederci.
The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are 2 ways you can attend, online or in person, with a link, appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.